Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, I'm Larry Mueller, and really pleased to have Melinda Myers back with us for 90 minutes or so here. Melinda hosts the PBS television show Great Lakes Gardener. She's the author of how many books?
About 20.
About 20 books. Most of them, many of them on gardening.
Right.
Almost all.
All of them are on gardening. I haven't done my Oprah book, you know, the one that's going to make me really famous.
But she's got, yeah, she does have lots. And you may have one or two or maybe 20 of them in your own library. So you know that she knows a lot about what's going on in the garden. So certainly if you have some questions for her, I hope you'll join us. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org. And what kinds of questions are you getting these days, Melinda?
Well, a lot of what do I do with my landscape now that it's, you know, fall is here and winter's coming? Is it going to be a hard winter? I have no idea. Will it survive? We'll all find out in spring. So tips on that, things that we can do to kind of fix the problems we saw this year. You know, every year I feel like I blame the weather, say it's a challenging year to garden in Wisconsin. But, you think about the long winter, the wet spring, the dry summer that so many of us didn't think about watering because it was so wet. Mm-hmm. Fall's been a little spotty in areas in terms of moisture. So, you know, I heard you the other day talk about you still had your garden hose out and you were still watering, you know, so it's supposed to rain and snow today here, I hear. So,
And in the Madison area, we kind of got dumped on a couple days ago with a lot of water. And it fell exactly as I was walking from the radio station to my other office. And
so we just need to call you when we are a little short on rainfall. Larry, could you take a walk?
I'll bring it. Don and Shano has a question for you. So let's go to Don. Don, thanks for waiting. Hi.
Thank you, Larry. Thank you for taking my call. Actually, if I could, I have two.
Okay.
One is my question. One is my wife.
Okay.
We have a border of prairie flowers around our property, about 4 feet deep. And one, we have a neighbor who never rakes his own leaves, so we end up with a lot of oak leaves getting tangled into our garden. And we do collect seeds and reseed. And my wife was wondering, how aggressively do we have to get these oak leaves out of there? And can we just leave some in for mulch? And then secondly, I'll hang up when I'm done. Secondly, we have some of our lawn grass kind of migrating into our flowers, and it drives me nuts, not so much my wife. And I was wondering if in springtime, because we've had these seeds on the ground all winter long, can I hit it with a pre-emergent type of a weed killer to try to kill that grass before my flowers start growing?
Don't hang up yet.
Okay,
do you cut back your prairie flowers in the spring? Is that how you manage it, or you just
actually the coreopsis when they kind of go to a seed head, we cut them because then we get a second blooming.
Okay,
but a lot of things like our coneflowers and things like that, we tend to leave them. It gives us a little interest in the snow. It looks nice. Birds eat some of the seeds.
And then you cut things back in the spring.
And then we cut them back in the spring.
Okay, yes. Great.
Okay.
That was my question before you hung up. and that's what I love to do, because one of the benefits is you do have the bird feed, the winter interest. It is Wisconsin, and that dead stuff poking out of the snow is really, I think, very beautiful.
I do, too.
A couple things about leaves. Leaves, especially big oak leaves, tend to mat down. They don't allow moisture through. They tend to ice up, and they're not good insulators. So I wouldn't worry about being too picky, but I'd get some of the bigger clumps out. What I do in my whole front yard is a garden, and I leave a lot stand, and I'll just try to get the worst of the leaves out. I shred them with my mower and then use them as a mulch, which seems like a lot of extra work, but it's really improving the soil. So I wouldn't worry if a few stay in. As things die back, it's a little easier to pull those out. Just keep in mind they're going to block the sunlight, going to interfere with some of the seeding and that type of thing, as well as poor insulation. In terms of lawn grass, even though the seeds are dropping in the fall and earlier in the spring, some of those pre-emergents might take out your good seed as well as your grass seed. So I'd be a little nervous about that. You might try edging the garden And that'll help slow down the grass. And the other thing you might want to do is, depending on how thick it is and how it's growing in, is maybe wipe on a total vegetation killer, being careful not to touch your prairie plants, your flowers. Mm-hmm. But if you get it just on the grass, or pulling it out or digging, which I know you end
a
up leaving
pain.
A lot of the rhizome mm-hmm. in, and you're going to be fighting it. But I think if you edge the bed, you'll slow things down greatly, and then your prairie plants should help shade it out and reduce the problem with the grass as a weed.
And we've been raking our lawn. I tell you, you know, the trees, the leaves don't all fall off at the same time.
No. And actually, at least I'm seeing the Norway maples drop earlier than normal. Usually they wait until the last pickup by the municipality you live in, and then they all drop. So you still, and you, I bet you still have at least half of them on the trees.
Yet. Yeah, we've got three major trees, and they drop one tree at a time drops.
One of the things that I like to encourage people to do is shred them with their mower.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, you cut them, and as long as you can see the grass for the leaf pieces, you can leave them on. It sounds like you've done that. So your next step is to shred them and then either compost them or dig them into your flower beds or vegetable gardens that are done for the season. Or I know a lot of gardeners will bag them up and they'll tuck them behind their foundation planting. So a little added insulation.
Mm-hmm.
So hopefully help with your heating cost. And then you've got them available to mulch your garden next year, because leaf mulch is wonderful.
Yeah, it's great stuff.
And, you know, I was just at Old Brook Botanic Garden before coming here, and, you know, they use a lot of leaf mulch and it's just beautiful. Looks good. And it's good for the soil, too.
Well, Don, I thank you for your call. Marge in Cumberland, thank you for waiting. Hi.
We're coming here.
Marge, are you there?
Hi, Marge. Can we help you?
Good.
Oh.
I think we're losing you.
I think we lost Marge. Marge, you might try again. Maybe she was on a cell phone. Let's go to Lucy in the Black Earth. Lucy, hi.
Hi there.
Hi, Lucy. How can I help?
I have a question on hostas.
Okay.
I have some planted by my front porch where the cats just tear through and jump on them, so they're just ruining them, so they need to be moved. When do you move them? How do you move them? I'm confused.
Okay, well, and don't, you know, you can read about 10 books and get 10 different ideas of when you can do it. My favorite times to move hostas are either in the spring, as they're just coming through the soil. They're easy to find, less foliage, easy to move. I've moved them the middle of the summer because I had to, and I won't tell you how much abuse those divisions took, but they still live despite my lack of tender, loving care. And then also late summer is another good time, August, September, when we're through the really heat of the summer and things are cooling down. The soil's warm, things root quickly, the air's cooler, so they get established. So you can move perennials anytime. You can give them good post-transplant care. Easier for you and the plants is either spring or late summer with the hostas. I like to dig up the whole clump. I use a linoleum knife and then just cut through that clump. Some people take two shovels back to back, or two garden forks back to back, and split them. I'm not quite that graceful and talented, I'll just be honest. I had a friend that would always hose off the soil and then pull apart the hostas, because the individual plants will pull apart. I'm just a leave the soil on the roots and put it back in the ground kind of person. Easier is what I'm going for. So,
yeah.
And I find digging the whole clump out, then you can cut it in halves, fourths, or eighths. The smaller the division, the slower it will fill in the area, but then you won't have to divide as frequently either.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't move them right now?
You could. You're just pushing your luck.
You're pushing your luck.
Because the roots aren't, you know, we're getting to the end of the season where the roots aren't going to fill in. And, you know, we've all pushed it. I've planted stuff this late, and sometimes it makes it and sometimes it doesn't. Planting is one thing, dividing is another. So if you can wait till spring, you'll have much better results.
I'll wait.
Add that to your list for spring.
Thanks, Lucy. Thank you for calling. Now I think Marge from Cumberland is back online here. Marge, hi.
Yes, good morning.
Hi, Marge.
My question is, I have a pond in my backyard, and I empty it out because it's only about a foot and a half deep. And I emptied it out already, and of course it fills up with rain, and I keep getting frogs in the bottom of the pond. And my question is whether or not I have to keep taking those frogs out for the winter. And right now, there's about 2 inches of water only in the bottom of it, and the frogs just keep coming into it, and I keep throwing them out and into the lake. So do I have to take them out? They will freeze solid, won't they, if I leave that leave them in that inch and a half or 2 inches of water?
Now, I know Scott was on the other day because I heard his show, and I'm wishing he was here right now. I'm honestly not sure what will happen with frogs. I would think with that little bit of water, I would think they would get out before it froze.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it seems like there are lots.
They're going to dig into the mud.
Right. And I don't know how much is left in your, if it's pretty clean and solid. I mean, you've probably cleaned out all the muck and the mud at the bottom of your pond.
Well, yeah. You see, I empty it out because I was afraid it would freeze solid anyway.
Right.
And so I drain it out, and then a couple of inches of water come in, and already I've emptied frogs out of there at least twice, and now they're back in there again, and it's snowing up here in Cumberland.
Okay.
And I wondered, well, do I have to go out there again in the snow and empty the frogs out? And because I hate to see them die down there.
I hear you. I guess what I would do is, I think as it's getting cold, I'm guessing if they can't dig into the mud, because you probably have a plastic preformed pond, I'm guessing they're going to leave, is my guess.
They can't leave. Well, all right. I think what I'll have to do is go out there and empty them out again.
Or
and,
put a little board in so they can climb up off the side. Is that what you're worried about? They can't hop out of there?
Well, that's right. It's about a foot and a half high. It's a plastic, pond.
Haul them out one more time.
Unless I leave it full. That's what I wondered, if I should just leave it full, but they go down to the bottom, and I think they'd freeze down in a foot and a half of water anyway.
Yeah, I'm not, to be honest, this is out of my expertise, but I'd probably stick a board in on an angle, and Larry's right, give them one more shot, get them out, put a board on an angle, and then they can climb up if it freezes, and you don't have to, you've done everything you can.
You've done all you can do, Marge, and, they want to go in there for some reason, who knows what, but...
maybe you could net it, too. After you get them out, put a little netting on top of the pond so that they don't go back in, and that might save you a little work.
Thanks for calling, Marge. And, by the way, as just a reminder to everybody, when you call in and you'll hear the melodious voice of Jim Packard, he will tell you to stay listening on the phone, and please do that. Don't try to listen on the radio because there's a little delay. It's about 7 seconds or so, and so that makes it a lot better when I say, Sharon and Durand, you're up, and then you're listening on the phone, and you immediately know you're up. Hi, Sharon.
Hi. I am probably the world's worst gardener, but this year my roses grew. I could hardly believe it. I've planted them quite a few years, and they always die. And I'm wondering what I can do to help them survive over the winter.
Do you know what kind of roses you have?
Have no idea.
Okay.
Are they big, kind of pinkish?
They're pinkish, and they're not huge, but they are a nice size rose. I was shocked. They bloomed way into the fall when it even got colder here. I don't know what I did to make it grow. I must have gotten a better plant.
Do they smell? Do they have a nice smell?
No, they don't have much of a smell.
Okay, well, then they're not roses.
Okay, might be a carefree series, too. Yeah. I know Larry's trying to go the same direction I am. A couple things. If it's a hybrid tea rose, these are usually grafted, though. The new generations are grown on their own roots. But the grafted roses could be a floribund or a hybrid tea. You'll see this knob right above there'll be the roots, a stem, and a knob. When you planted it, if there was that knob, that's where the graft was. And hopefully you put it a couple inches below the soil surface to insulate it for winter. Usually hybrid teas and grafted rose benefits from winter protection. And even the new generation of hybrid teas will benefit from some winter protection. There's a lot of different methods. I was just at Old Brook and they were starting to protect their roses. I like to wait for a week of freezing temperatures. They have so many that they have to start early to get it all done. But since you and I have the luxury of only having a few, so if your roses need protection, wait till for about a week of freezing temperatures. Then I like to do the soil mound method. And what I thought was neat, they used just some plastic netting or screening and made little, baskets or fencing around the roses and filled it with about 10 inches of soil. Once that freezes, compost or soil, so that holds it all together. Once that freezes, then you can cover the top with straw, marsh hay, or evergreen boughs and loosely tie them together so they don't blow around. I'm not a big fan of rose cones, and here's why. People put them on too early and take them off too late, and that gets warm underneath there, even if it's cold outside, but it's a sunny day. And then I often find them blowing down the block as well. So I'm not a big fan of rose cones, though. There are people that will swear by them, and they found the right way to do it. If you do use rose cones, I'd still put a mound of soil underneath the rose cone and then put the rose cone on top, a lot of people pour soil around the edge so it freezes in place and a brick on top to hold it intact. If it's a shrub rose, and now Sharon, you're wishing they would have died, aren't you? If it's a shrub rose, those are pretty hardy, and the Rugosas, the Knockouts, the Carefree series, leave them stand for winter. And I do that with even hybrid teas because the more growth on top, the hardier and the better able to survive winter. And you don't need to do protection if it's a shrub rose. So if you can dig through and find the tags for that rose, or if you bought it at a local nursery or garden center, if you don't remember seeing the knobby growth on the stem, it's not grafted, then you're probably okay leaving it stand for winter. And the winter interest of roses, the fall color is incredible this year on some of those Rugosa roses.
Man,
unbelievable.
We have six big flowers on our Rugosa right now, and they're just gorgeous. And, of course, earlier, as soon as a flower came out, the Japanese beetles took them. I mean, within minutes.
Isn't it amazing? I had them for the first time in my yard this year, and it's like, oh, man. So I'll feel your pain more so next year. But yeah, so enjoy the bloom. Wait until we've had a good spell of cold if you are going to cover them. But shrub roses, that's the beauty. They don't need protection, and that's the ones I choose to grow for that reason. A lot easier to care for.
Thanks, Sharon, for calling. Mal Myers, our guest today. Melinda Myers hosts the PBS television show Great Lakes Gardener, the author of 20 gardening books. And she's here to answer all of your questions at 1-800-642-1234. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer, here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Melinda Myers, our guest here on this edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here. Melinda, Donna in Madison has emailed us a question wondering, should I cut my peonies down to the ground now or leave them until spring?
With peonies, you might as well cut them down as they go dormant. You know, if you're still, depending on where you are, and I was just at Ulbrich, and there's some things looking good, and in Milwaukee, we haven't had, too many of us have had a hard frost. So as long as there's some green on the leaves, I like to leave them intact. But if this is your weekend to clean up, go ahead and cut them back, especially if you had any leaf spot diseases. If you've had Botrytis phytophthora blight, where they get those big purpley-black spots and they look really ugly, fall cleanup will really help reduce the problem. If you just saw a few spots, I'd still clean them up. That's one that they usually fall down on the ground anyway. They don't provide a lot of winter interest. And take those out of the garden now. To be honest, I've left mine if I don't get around to cleaning them up, but I don't have diseases on mine. But if I did, they'd be high on the list of cleaning up in the fall.
They'd be out of there.
Right.
Lon emailed us from Marshfield. He says, my wife and I received a hanging bridal veil plant as a gift for our wedding this May. We hung it outside all summer, and I'll have it inside. Seems to have overgrown its planter, as messy as it drops a lot of leaves and such, as you might expect. Can we cut it back? Can it be cut back and transplanted? What would be your suggestions to keep it alive over the winter so we can enjoy it for as long as possible?
Bridal veil is one of those plants. I started my career doing interior plantscaping, and we used a lot of bridal veil. And what you describe is really what happens to those plants. They get bare stems at the top. They get really kind of ratty. You move them around, you leave cuttings everywhere you go. So, yes, you can cut them back. Good bright light if you can get it inside. You know, outside, I'd always move mine out under the filtered light of a tree in a nice humidity, bright light, but not direct. But inside, you know, if you can get it in a good sunny window, you can root those cuttings very easily. It may or may not be pot bound. They tend to just get ratty looking anyway. So if you're going to transplant it, a container 1 inch bigger in diameter, but I'd probably wait until after the holidays. And here's why. Your plant's going through a lot of stress. And I know you were thinking, Larry, the leaves are dropping. It's been outside. It's coming inside.
Yep.
So it's shedding those leaves that really block some of the sunlight out because it had more light outside. Now it needs to put on some more shade light, shade leaves. It'll pull more light in and be able to better adjust to the new climate. So you're going to see some ratty growth for a while. So pruning will encourage branching. If you water thoroughly and the soil's moist and the water runs right out the bottom, yeah, it's time to transplant. If the soil's slightly moist and you water and most of the water stays in, there's still enough soil in there for the plant. That's one way I tell if it's pot bound. But if you water and it runs right out, it's time to move
time
it. So just about an inch bigger in diameter. But you might want to start with a haircut, see how that goes. Start some of those, root some of those cuttings. You can always give them as gifts for Christmas, too.
Absolutely. Karen in Jefferson, thanks for waiting. Hi.
Hello. this year my garden was terrible. It was very stunted. I think it was due to all the rain we had out here. We were high up. Everything looked normal, so we didn't replant. My flowers got as tall as I could only put them in shot glasses. People that expect beans from us thought we hated them. I said, no, we still like you. We just don't have much yield on our plants. You know, just enough for two people, but my orchard went bonkers. Now, I'm out in the country. My vegetable garden is in the front, and my mini orchard is in the back, and it's separated by 2 or 3 acres. And I've had probably across the board fruit basket-size apples. Now, this was great until about 3 weeks ago when there's some kind of airborne blight. Now, my husband has, we use sustainable agricultural practices that we've learned through the UW and all that. And even our raised beds in our vegetable garden, you know, I think that might have disguised, how bad our garden really was because we didn't have puddles or anything.
Right.
But anyway, in the back there in the orchard, we had this blight or something. It affected the leaves and the fruit on about the last 5 trees we had. Now, the first five trees that we had were the apples mature between August 1st and the end of September. Now, the October ones were affected, and then one that usually fruits in September or is ready to be picked in September was late.
What did the blight look like?
Okay.
What did the leaves look like in the apples themselves?
Okay. Well, the it's an irregular-shaped blight on the leaves, and it causes them to dry up and fall off. But the fruit, the blight is just skin deep. And on the red apples, if you get to them, it starts looking green, then it starts turning black. There's nothing you can do about the yellow apples. I have Honey Gold out of Minnesota, and I have Golden Delicious. Now, the Golden Delicious are the absolute worst.
Okay. If you're familiar with it, sounds to me like apple scab, and usually we see it a little bit earlier. And your description of the spots, and they're kind of a, it looks like when you do watercolor paint, kind of a real soft, feathery edge to it. And they do start out kind of an olive green and then turn black.
Right.
In really bad years, you'll see apples, crab apples and apples have dropped their leaves in July, and then the fruit can be affected, like you said, skin deep. And so what you're... In terms of management from a sustainable standpoint, it's really raking and getting rid of the leaves that have dropped and getting rid of any of the fruit that falls down because those spores will overwinter. I don't know if you're using any of the, if you're using any kind of spray because everybody's idea of organic and sustainable is a little different.
No, he took these classes.
Okay. Yeah. And one of the things I would suggest then is just good sanitation. The weather this year, here's the problem with diseases, is you need a susceptible plant. Apples are susceptible to scab. You need the fungus, and there's plenty of scab fungus out there. And then you need the right weather conditions. And when typically it's a cool, wet spring, we see problems. Well, we had so much moisture.
Right.
And then it got dry, and then we started getting some rain again. And I'm wondering if you just had some disease, and then the weather just was a lot better for the disease later in the season, and that's why you're seeing it. If you typically don't have a problem, that's great. So I would just rake, get rid of anything that falls and drops. You're right. Saving those scab-infested fruit, they're not going to last long, so those are the ones you might want to make into sauce and juice and things. You know, remove the skin so that you've got that flesh to use, but don't save them because they're going to infect the others and won't last long. So those are the things that I'd recommend happening. And as far as your garden, I do want to just take a minute to talk about all the flood damage. And you're right, sometimes we don't see the damage right away. And a couple things happened with the floods. A lot of the particulate matter was washed into our soil. So it was washed from one area into another. So well-drained soils, all that organic matter settled, filled in the pores. So we had poor drainage. We have a lot of organic matter washed from some gardens into other gardens. So you might be a lack of that. Your roots were saturated. You had poor root very few roots. So when we hit the drought, there weren't a lot of roots to pull up the moisture. So the best thing, if you think your garden suffered from drought problems, is to work the soil, adding organic mm-hmm. matter, compost, an activated compost like a Purple Cow, and working it into the soil either now or in the spring is a good way to kind of help revive that soil a bit. And that should fit into your sustainable practices. Mm-hmm. I'm a big fan of shredding leaves and dig them in the garden. By next spring, you can't tell they're there. And it's a great way to recycle them in your landscape.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't know, what about back to the apples for a minute, just taking a look at those trees and making sure that they're pruned properly as
good
well.
Good airflow.
So you've got some good airflow in those branches and so forth?
Never hurts. It's a good strategy. And the whole sustainable idea is the right plant, the right location, and right care. And pruning for production is really important. So
good luck, Karen. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. We'll give some others a chance to get on here, so let's go to Eric in Burlington. Eric, hello.
Hello. Hi, just wanted to offer a suggestion to the woman in Cumberland who has a pond that freezes with frogs in the winter.
Good.
We have a pond here. It has a plastic bottom. I think it attracts frogs, and perhaps they think that they are able to dig into the bottom for the winter.
Right.
And then it's too late when they find out it's plastic. We've gone through it a number of years, and finally, if the goal is to not have the frogs freeze, you can get a little pump from the hardware store, pump out the pond, and have it dry until cold weather comes. And at that time, the frogs won't return, and you'll have the problem solved.
So just keep pumping the water out. Yeah. So I think she was trying to avoid that, but thank you, Eric, because I appreciate your insight, because I think she's going to give him one more shot. So maybe you've inspired her.
Thanks for
calling. You guys certainly are inspiring. I enjoy your show.
Oh, thanks, Eric. Thanks for calling. Appreciate it. Jan in Delafield, we're on to you now. Hi, Jan.
Good morning. In midsummer, I purchased some arborvitae. They were 1 foot high, and I planted them in our vegetable garden because the site I have for them wasn't ready yet. The instructions I got were to plant them in the fall when things go dormant. Well, here we are, first part of November, and I really wouldn't say things are dormant, but it's still an acceptable time to transplant those trees.
You know what? If I was you, I like to get my evergreens in the ground by October 1st, and I like to get them in the ground, and I like to have them have that good month or so to root in. There are a lot of professionals that do dormant season transplanting of evergreens, but they dig them, let the root ball freeze, move it in the middle of winter, and they have the equipment and the staff to do it. If you can wait till spring, I think you're going to have much better success. You know, we're lucky that we usually have a long spring. Our hot part of summer is mid to later in the season. It's not as bad as if we were down south. My concern with evergreens, too, is they're going to continue to lose moisture all winter long. So if you can leave them in the garden, and then as soon as the soil is workable in the spring, then I would move them at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Okay.
All right, thanks. And on to Rebecca in Platteville. Hi, Rebecca.
Hi. Well, I'm looking for a series of suggestions for some undergrowth. I have a backyard woodlot that I have removed umpteen multiflora rows and gooseberry bushes, but above them were very, very tall walnuts, hard maple, elm, oak, and there's some bittersweet coming up, which is fine. But I would like to have some bushes, some undergrowth that is not gooseberry and not multiflora rose, that is shade tolerant, can take rough soil. It's not great. I know hostas will grow there, but I would like something a little bit more wildlife-y and something that would be good for them.
Okay.
Any ideas?
Yeah, and you want some shrubs, it sounds like.
I'd like to have, a second story type stuff,
Right. One of my concerns is I heard walnuts mentioned.
Yep,
the next thing is black walnuts can be challenging.
Oh, yeah.
Some viburnums are tolerant of black walnuts, and so I would try, and the list vary. You can look up a list of plants that are tolerant of black walnuts, and it's
all
observation.
Are they shade tolerant? Because it's shady.
Yeah, your viburnums really will do very well. The American viburnum, cranberry bush viburnum, is an understory plant that you'll see in shaded areas. Arrowwood viburnum, you'll get better fall color and a little more light, but they'll do well.
Arrowwood. Arrowwood.
Okay. Yeah, viburnum dentatum. They're beautiful fall color right now. Blueberries that the birds like.
Okay.
Serviceberry or amelanchier. To be honest, I can't remember seeing it on a list of tolerant to black walnut plants, but you might want to, you know, if you Google, if you have access to the internet, Google black walnut toxicity, and the top two or three lists that come up is Ohio State's list, Cornell, Purdue University. Those two have a pretty extensive list, but serviceberry or amelanchier, it's another native plant that is a shade-tolerant plant. It's an understory tree.
Say that one again.
Serviceberry.
Okay, serviceberry.
Or Juneberry, they call it. Chokeberries, again, I haven't seen them on the list, but there's a red-fruited one and a black-fruited one, and they'll take shade and they'll take moist soil.
Okay.
One I'm a little worried about from the black walnut standpoint, you don't see it a lot, but it's great for shade. So for those people with shade, but don't have the black walnuts, and you might want to try one, black jet bead, rhodotypus, which is R-H-O-D-O-T-Y-P-O-S, rhodotypus, black jet bead. I'm seeing it more and more available and seeing it used a little bit more, so you might want to try that as well. Hemlocks will take some shade maybe on the edge of the woods if you want a little bit of evergreen in there. You know, the dense shade will be hard on them. You might want to do some carex. The native carexes or sedges are good shade tolerance, and they'll take, most of those will take the black walnut too.
Yeah.
Northwind perennials, which is located just north of Lake Geneva, has a nice demonstration garden growing under black walnuts. And I always send people out there. I'm not sure what their hours are this time of year, but they've got a website. But I always send people out there because then you can see they've got some viburnums, they've got some sedges. They had shooting stars mixed in with their sedges. It was beautiful. Canadian ginger is one that you might want to give a try to. It's a native. It's a good ground cover and shade tolerant. Really thrives very well. So those would be some I would consider trying.
Mm-hmm. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Dave wonders, is Canis a bulb, and can a permanent perennial bed be planted in southern Wisconsin?
And Canis, the Canis are, they're rhizomes, and they're not hardy here. I think they're zone 6B or 7, where they can make it through the winter. So with the Cannas, if you've ever driven through Milwaukee, down the boulevards, you've seen Cannas, the big, huge leaves, the orange or yellow or pink flowers. So the thing you need to do with them is after the frost kills the top, lift them out, let them cure. And that's what you do with all your non-hardy bulbs. Just sit in a warm, dry place with Cannas overnight or a couple of days is usually enough. Remove the excess foliage. Just brush carefully, gently brush off the loose soil. We're not going to scrub them. And then store them in peat moss vermiculite or perlite. And some people do sand in a cool, dark place. Cannas of all the non-hardy bulbs are the easiest I find to store. And you probably put a couple in and you ended up with a huge clump. So you can save them. You can start them inside if you want earlier bloom, or plant them right outside the end of May. So they're a little putsy, but boy, the foliage is nice on them. The flower color is good. Mix them with ornamental grasses, and you can really have a really nice looking garden. Or you can start with new plants every year. Find some friend that likes a challenge. Let them say, here, I have a present. Maybe they'll share a few rhizomes back with you in the spring.
And a permanent perennial bed?
To put those in there, or?
The question is, can a permanent perennial bed be planted in southern Wisconsin?
Well, exactly. Yeah. Not using the Cannas. I thought maybe you were thinking of using the Cannas. Yeah, I know that, you know, sometimes it seems you read the gardening books and you go, that won't grow here, that won't grow here. But you know what? There's a lot of things that do grow here. And the thing that I recommend is if you're really getting antsy, there's still a little time to prepare the soil depending on how much snow we do get. But, you know, fall's a great time to prep the garden. And then spring is a good time to plant it. You know, we're a little late to do a lot of planting right now, though. I have a few things that I'm going to pop in the ground this weekend, I hope. But, you know, it's a good time to prep your garden. If you do have plants, you can heal them in, or you can plant them transplanting. I'd wait till spring at this point if you can. But yeah, there's lots of choices. My recommendation is Wisconsin has some great botanical gardens. Green Bay Botanic Garden, Olbrich Botanical Garden, here in Madison.
Janesville Rotary Garden
is excellent. Berner Botanical Gardens in Milwaukee, Allen Centennial on the UW campus, Payne Arboretum up in Oshkosh. And I know I'm forgetting some, and I apologize for that. But, you know, check out the gardens in your area, and that's a great way to get some ideas for combination, things that are thriving, and really help you as you're planning your garden.
Paul in Duluth, Minnesota is up next. Paul, hi.
Hi, I hope this, thank you very much. I hope this is a pretty simple question. Like some of the other callers I've been hearing, because of the wet, cold spring, my overall garden was kind of a bust this year. But I do have one rosemary plant that I bought this year, and it grew quite well, and I trimmed it back to dry some of the branches, and now I'm wondering how best I can overwinter it.
Yeah, I'll tell you, rosemary is just a beautiful plant, and it can be challenging to keep alive over winter. Mm-hmm. If you've got a space with a good sunny window and watch the moisture, it's not real forgiving if you forget to water it. I'll confess, mine dies every year about March. I get busy traveling, I kind of don't keep up with the watering, and all of a sudden it's like, oh man, I've been on the road for 2 weeks and my rosemary's dead. The good news, it still smells good, even
but,
though it's dead.
I can't overwinter it outside.
Not outside, no, I'm afraid not, and especially not in Duluth. You guys are a tough group of gardeners, and I was lucky enough to speak to the Gitche-Gumee Garden Club a few years ago. But the rosemary just won't make it outside for me here in a zone 5. So definitely, unfortunately, not for you. So you'll need to bring it in, grow it like a houseplant in a good sunny window, water it. Just don't let it go dry, like slightly moist soil. And with some luck, you'll have a rosemary plant throughout the winter, and you can harvest from it and enjoy the fragrance as you brush by as well.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Good luck with that, Paul.
Thanks a lot for calling. And we'll take some more calls. You can join us at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller with Melinda Myers here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking your questions on this edition of Garden Talk with Melinda Myers, host of the Great Lakes Gardener on public television. She's authored 20 books on gardening and has been a regular on our show for, oh my goodness.
We were both very young when we started. How's that?
We were very young. Very young. Deb in Milwaukee has a question for you. Deborah, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. This is great. I have an idea for a book that I think you'd probably be more likely to write than I would.
Okay.
And the title is Don't Even Think of Planting That Tree There. I see silver maples, like I know people who have silver maple. Well, they moved and built a new house, but their old house had a silver maple like 10 feet in front of it, and I think they had to snake their plumbing out like twice a year. So anyway, and also I met this girl about 5 years ago, and she didn't know what this plant was, and it was growing by her dryer vent. Every year it would come up. It was a passion flower.
Oh, wow.
So I just wanted to give that little tip out for anybody who wants to stretch the zone limitations. The dryer vents come in handy.
That's great. That's wonderful. She probably did more laundry more often than I did, so it was warm enough. Because one of the challenges is, as you know, Deb, that you need to find something that helps nudge and keep the season going versus get it growing, get it stopping, get it growing. I know about a dozen gardeners in southeast Wisconsin that have passion flowers, and the ones that are successful are getting runners up in their yard. And as you know, that's a plant that's hard to keep alive over winter. So it seems that they're either those people that have found the right spot, like your friend who's got hers by the dryer vent, and it's doing well, and it's surviving and thriving, or they die, which is more common. So
more
thanks
common.
For sharing that. And I love your title. When I looked for my home, actually, I was married at the time, my ex-husband and I, and he would drive by. He was also in horticulture. Ah, we're not taking down the spruce trees. Ah, it's got a silver maple there. We're not even going to look at that house. I mean, we never even walked in the door. So he would love this title.
I want to ask one other thing. I've been looking. I saw on this little segment of public TV, like this guy just gives like a little synopsis of, or it's like just like a 10-minute little short film of on beach, a European beach, and the branches would branch down and touch the ground.
Right.
And I just fell in love with that tree, but I don't see any here.
You know, European beaches and even American beaches are available. They're a little bit slower growing and a little harder to find, so you're going to want to look around at the nurseries. One of my favorite is Tricolor Beach, which is a cultivar of the European beach, and the leaves are green, cream, and pink. Just gorgeous. Mm. The Copperleaf Beach has a kind of a coppery reddish tinge to the leaf. The bark, you saw the trees, a smooth gray bark. Now in Wisconsin, the beaches, typically the native beaches, the American beaches, kind of ran up along the southeast and along the lake, and then there's another batch of them sort of in central Wisconsin. The American beach don't transplant as readily, and that's why we don't see them available from nurseries, but they're starting to become more available. What I would do is put the word out. I know in Milwaukee, I think Johnson's Nursery, you might check Hawks or Milliger's or some of those places that tend to carry a little bit more diversity and a little harder to find plants. But I would get on the phone and call first.
Yeah.
But the Tricolor Beach I put into a friend's landscape I purchased in the Milwaukee area. So I know they're out there, but you have to look a little bit. So
I'll pick Miners.
Yeah, that's true. I forgot about Miners. I think they've carried them in the past, too.
Oh, thank you so much. Well, have a great day.
You too, Deb.
You too. Thanks, Deb. Keith in River Falls, on to you now. Hi, Keith.
Good morning.
Morning.
Hi, Keith.
Yes, I have a clematis, a smaller type. It's been there for maybe 10 years, but I would like to move it, and I wonder if moving it at this time would be okay.
You know, you kind of heard my bias. I'm one of those people that at this point, if you have to move it, you could. I would probably wait until spring and just before growth begins, get the space prepared. And when you can get in there, you're going to have that cooler temperatures of spring. You're going to have that long period to get established before the heat of summer moves in.
Going to have better luck.
And a little bit better luck, yeah. If you know, it's that hard time. This is the second best time to do your transplanting. But if you can wait, I would do it in the spring.
All right.
What shape of root ball? Are their roots go deep or they go spread out wide?
Well, you know, the key thing is whenever you're digging a perennial is dig a root ball that you can manage. Bottom line is the bigger is always better, but if you drop it, you're in worse shape. So, you know, if you can go at least a foot, foot and a half in diameter and down about 6 or 8 inches, you'll be in good shape. And that's probably something you can manage.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, if you can go a little deeper, that's even better. But if you can do a foot, foot and a half in diameter, 2 would be even better. And then about 8 to 12 inches deep, you should be in good shape.
All right. Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks a lot for calling. Chris in Palmyra has a question. I was given a hibiscus tree as a gift this summer. Did great outside in full sun, lots of water. I have since brought it in, looking a little peaked. It's getting some light and regular water. Is this just transitional outside to inside, or should I do something more specific?
When you ask me what my questions I'm getting, I forgot the hibiscus question because that is the time. And they're wonderful plants. And you're exactly right, Chris. It's going through that transition. It's shedding those leaves that have been blocking out the sunlight that are used to getting full sun. They'll put out some new leaves soon, depending on how much light you have. There are a couple ways of overwintering hibiscus. The best for the plant is a good sunny window and treat it like a house plant. I like to wait till after the first of the year to do my pruning because often you get flowers. Mine will bloom through the holidays.
Yeah.
So who wants to cut them off?
Right.
You know, and then after that, you want to get your pruning done by the end of February. As soon as you're getting new growth, use a dilute solution of a flowering houseplant fertilizer. You want to beef up that phosphorus to encourage bloom. And then when it's outside, you want to use a flowering plant fertilizer, and that'll encourage bloom. I've run mine in a little bit lower light and cooler temperatures, barely keeping it alive, not letting it die back. It's not going dormant, but I really didn't have a good spot for it, so I keep it in my laundry room in an east-facing window in the basement. So I remember to water it, but I don't need to water it as often. The temperatures are cooler. I don't fertilize because it's not growing. So if you don't have a great spot, that's the next best thing to do. But if you can treat it like a houseplant, your plant will appreciate it and do much better.
Dennis in Janesville has a question for you. Hi, Dennis.
Hello. I was out walking my dog a few weeks ago, and I stumbled across an elderberry plant that was growing at the edge of this wooded area, and I hadn't seen a lot of those around, so I actually grabbed a couple of bunches of the berries. So is it possible for me to actually plant those and make them grow, or do I have to do something special? I know some seeds, you know, you have to scrape them to get them to grow or something. Is there something special I need to do with elderberries?
I'm wondering if they might need a little bit of scarification only because the birds are usually ones that are planting it. So
yeah.
Usually when it's something that a bird plants for you, and if you don't go through that passing of their system, sometimes that's helpful. I would probably also store them cold. So what I would probably do is take the fleshy part off of the seeds, store them in the refrigerator. And since you've got, you know, a couple bundles of elderberries, a lot of seeds. So you probably have enough that you can experiment with that you could just take a file and scrape or a little bit of sandpaper, fine sandpaper, and scrape the seed surface and plant those. And you could do some without and see if it works for you too. You know, control and a little bit of an experiment there. But the other thing, there's a great, and I don't think he's got anything online, but if you can get to a library that might have it, Michael Dirr, Manual of Woody Landscape Plants.
Yeah, that's a good one.
It is. And Sam Bucus, S-A-M-B-U-C-U-S is the botanical name for elderberry. You might even be able to Google online and ask and check on propagating. But he talks a lot about propagation, and you're absolutely right, Dennis. When it comes to trees and shrubs, they're a lot pickier about how you start the seeds, when you take your cuttings, and how you treat them. So, you know, if you know any really hardcore plant geek friends, they'll probably have Michael Dirr's book. Or if you Google Sam Bucus, I like to do that because then you tend to get more reliable sources using the botanical names. And boy, I find a wealth of knowledge from on the internet from universities and extension services. So you might either experiment a little bit or double check.
And thanks for calling. Fran and Nina, on to you now. Hi, Fran.
Oh, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm excited. My landlord had some peonies, and the landscaper kept cutting them down because she told him to. They're beautiful flowers in spite of the ants. And I'd like to know, I dug them up in the summertime, and I put them in a large pot because I didn't know where to plant them exactly. Now, they're still in a large pot. Can I plant them in the ground?
Sure. If you have the spot prepared, go ahead and plant them. If you don't, or you're not sure that's where you want to put them, you can heel them in.
Okay.
So just pop them into the, sink the pot in the ground, the whole thing. And then in the spring, you can lift that container out. You basically are just trying to insulate the roots.
Right.
You can lift that container out and put it in the spot you want. Go ahead.
There's this tree stump. If I get some nice dirt, can I plant them around the tree stump? Would that be all right?
You know, depending on if you can get through those roots, a lot of the roots coming right out of the trunk are pretty big and pretty thick. And then being able to dig down in there, what you may want to do is, I don't know how big that tree stump is, or if you want to start maybe prepping the site now for that peony.
Okay.
I'm just worried, and especially if are you getting suckers off that tree stump, or is it good and dead?
It's good and dead.
Okay, because sometimes, you know, we cut down trees and we end up getting a forest coming up out of it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and the other thing you want to watch for, tree roots are slow to break down, so just watch the nitrogen. If your plants are looking a little peaked or pale, you might need to give it a little extra fertilizer, but I'd stick with a low nitrogen, slow release fertilizer so that you don't promote leaf growth and no flowering. So you could pop it in the ground. You know, planting at this time of the year from a container in the ground, you know, is different than transplanting. You have a little bit better luck in terms of getting it in there, or again, you can heal it in the pot and all, someplace in a protected spot, and then next spring have that area all ready to go.
Mm-hmm. Good luck. Thanks for calling. And Alan Wausau, your turn. Hi, Al.
Hi, Larry. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, why do experts and people in the field believe that hydrogen peroxide is not a safe product to use on their vegetation?
I'll tell you why I'm not a fan of the Jerry Baker pull it out of under the sink and put it in and mix it up, the Lysol, the hydrogen peroxide, and all of those. There's a couple reasons. You know, my background is working with the university and doing research or using research-based information. And a lot of things are anecdotal, meaning you did it now. If you did 100 of them and you did it over several years, would you get the same results? It's not been tested and it's not recommended on plants. So legally, I can't recommend it to you,
right.
You know, because it's not, depending on how you want to use it. Also, the other thing is when you start pricing out some of these products to get the elements that they're providing, it's often more expensive than just going out and buying a fertilizer of sorts. And so, and then sometimes when a company changes the formulation of something that's not aimed for a garden, it may have a negative impact. For example, soap. Insecticidal soap is just a soap that's effective at killing insects, but not harmful on plants and soft on the environment. You could use ivory dish soap, but if you read Organic Garden Magazine when it went from that cloudy, milky substance to the clear substance, there were hundreds of letters from gardeners because when they changed the formulation to make your dishes brighter, it also burned your plants. And so I tend to be very cautious because I haven't tested it and I haven't seen enough of it replicated that what's the impact not only on the plant but the environment and some of the incidentals that we're not watching for fungi. There's a lot of good fungus and bacteria in the soil that we need. So are you killing the good guys by doing that? So that would be one of my concerns with the hydrogen peroxide, just knowing what we use it on our bodies, that it could be doing something similar to the soil and the whole ecosystem as well.
Thanks, Al, for calling. Melinda Meyer is our guest here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here with my guest, gardening expert extraordinaire, Melinda Myers of Milwaukee. Happy to have her back. And all our lines are filled, and we've had lots of emails. Carrie in Madison has an email for you. My peace lily is very wilted, looking and droopy, but I water it, not too much. It did go through a dry spell, but it never bounced back from the droopiness. Should I cut off the old droopy leaves to stimulate new growth? How do you cut it back? Just cut the leaves back at the base? I hate to lose it because it's from my grandmother's funeral.
You know, always those gift plants or those special sentimental plants always seem to be the hardest. Peace lilies will forgive you a few times if you let them go too dry, but at some point it reaches that permanent wilting point and it doesn't recover. I'll tell you, Carrie, I quit growing peace lilies, at least at this point in my life, because, you know, I'd come home and the leaves would be laying flat. You water, they perk up, and they'll do that a couple times, and then eventually they don't perk up. As long as the leaves are green, they're still producing energy, I'd leave them intact and let new growth come through that older growth. The key thing is don't let it go too dry. Make sure with any of your house plants, and you know, as we're leaving our focus outside, coming inside, this is a good time to look at your plants. Make sure that if you've got saucers underneath it, all your plants have drainage holes, put them in saucers. And I like to keep pebbles in the bottom in that saucer. Set the pot on the pebble, so when I water thoroughly, the excess is held in the pebbles. The plant sits on those pebbles, not in the water, so I don't have that risk of overwatering or having root rot. The other advantage is it creates humidity right around the plants where it's needed. So what I would say is if you water it every 4 days or every 5 days, check it every 3 or 4 days, you know, a day sooner, and make sure that you start watering it. If the leaves start yellowing, yeah, then cut them off right back at ground level where they come out at the stem. And then just keep doing that. And you'll eventually, if the root system isn't dead, you should get some new growth coming up as well.
Tom in Stoddard is next. Tom, hi.
Hi. I'm wondering about being able to use the root from the cannas. I have a lot of the old-fashioned type, the canna endeavor, and I want to switch to the other varieties that have nicer flowers, more similar to the gladiolus. But I get so much production on the old-fashioned type, and I just kind of hate to leave them outside and just freeze. I have given some away to other people, but if they're a true lily, can person eat the tubers?
The only one that I know, and it's funny because I was just at a talk and I was trying to remember the story about those. And the only thing I've ever seen is a certain species called Canna edulis, E-D-U-L-I-S, as being edible. And I would hate to test my luck on anything.
No.
My understanding is where it's native, the people in that region will use it as a starch source, much like taro and the poi. So I would say that you might want to find some more gardeners that might be willing. If there's a master gardener group in your area, a lot of them do plant sales in the spring to raise money so they can do more outreach and education. And there might be some master gardeners that are willing to take those and then sell them in the spring and as part of their plant sale, or use them in a community garden or a kid's garden. Or, you know, if there's a school somewhere, that might be another good place to recycle them. I just find that there's usually a home for plants. Sometimes you just have to look for it. And then the bottom line, if they die and they decompose in your garden, they haven't gone to waste because they're improving the soil. So it's just a different way of recycling the plants.
And, you know, in our neighborhood or in our area, we have one of these freeware websites.
Precycle
or whatever. Freecycle, it's called.
Freecycle, that's it, right.
And we've actually put a few things, including some plants, up on that Freecycle, and boom, they're gone. I mean, people react very quickly to that. And, Tom, you might try that. Look under Freecycle and see if you can find a local one for you.
That's a great idea. Or even if, depending on your neighborhood, just put them in a box outside with a sign. Please give them a good home.
Thanks for calling. Joya in Fitchburg, we're on to you. Hi, Joya. Joya,
hi.
Lost Joya. Joanne in Jacksonport. Hi, Joanne. Whoops. No, I did that myself. Colleen in Cumberland. Your turn. Hi, Colleen.
Hi. I'm wondering if I can dig up my lavender plant and pot it to use as a house plant in the winter.
And you're going to have to help me. Are you a zone 4 in Cumberland or a zone 3?
I believe 3.
Okay. And I apologize. I should have my map in front of me. One of the reasons I was asking, I've seen lavender do okay in the Twin Cities area, which is a zone 4. Drainage is critical. You really, that's about your only choice is, you know, unless you want to see if you can get lucky and have it survive outside. What I find with lavender, zone 5 is even a little borderline. Drainage is critical. Zone 4, I've seen it like Hidcote and Munstead and a few of the others make it through if the drainage was good. Sometimes after the ground freezes, put some evergreen boughs over top. But yeah, at this point, if you're willing to bring it in and grow it, if you can find a cool, sunny location, that's going to be a lot easier than a warm location indoors. The transition's going to be pretty tough from outside inside. What I like to do with plants that I'm bringing inside is I'll grow them in containers and sink the pot in the ground for the summer. Doesn't help you now, but for next year. Sink it in the ground so it looks like it's growing there. But then in the fall when I lift it up, it's easier for me and easier on the plant. I'm not destroying so many roots. So, you know, you have nothing to lose because if you make it through a lavender through in a zone 3, we all want to hear about it. So that's quite the accomplishment and pat yourself on the back.
Do I prune it when I bring it in?
I would just leave it intact. There's two trains. Okay. There are two ways of thinking. I know there are a lot of horticulturists that cut everything back when they bring it inside. And my feeling is the more stems, the more leaves, the more chance you got something to grow and photosynthesize inside. Yeah. And then do your trimming after when things start improving, do your trimming. But I'd leave it intact and then wait until spring to clean it up a bit.
Thanks, Colleen, for calling. Leslie emailed and has over 100 roses and probably as many evergreens. Can I use horse manure as a mulch and winter protection?
Well, with the evergreens, I wouldn't pile anything around the base of the evergreens.
No.
Mainly what we worry about there is if they're broadleaf evergreens or new plantings or they're subject to winter winds or winter sun, a little bit of screening like some burlap or, you know, anything that decorative fencing, lattice to cut the wind a bit and to provide a little shade. With the manure, I guess if it's aged and you know there's not a lot of nitrogen in there and probably some bedding mixed in, it's probably pretty comparable to compost and you'd be okay. You want to just make sure that you've got good drainage. So depending on how aged it is, but if things seem to drain through it, it should be fine. You're right. When you talk about mounding soil around roses, and I'm glad you brought this up, mm-hmm. Leslie, you don't want to dig the soil from around the rose and pile it up because then you expose the roots. And if you wait for a week of freezing temperature, you're going to find a lot of the soil is a little crunchy out there. So compost is a great thing to use. So if you have a compost pile, use that compost, and then you can just kind of peel it off or let the spring rains wash it away, and you've amended the soil. Or buying compost or topsoil from a garden center, keeping it in a garage or someplace where it doesn't freeze, and then just popping it on top. I just make sure that you've got good drainage through that horse manure and that it's like compost. And then you should be okay if it's composted. You may want to mix a little topsoil in there and just to be sure.
She also, her roses are over 6 feet tall. What's the best type of tie? She says to keep it. Protect from the wind. Pantyhose, would that work?
Yeah, pantyhose, twine. You may even want to just decide, I'm going to either create a windbreak or just let them blow. The problem with blowing is they end up getting damaged and things. So, just a quick little twine. The benefit of twine is you can clip, 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 and then just leave it lay, and it'll eventually decompose in the garden, too.
Joanne in Jacksonport, your turn. Hi, Joanne.
Hi. I have two quick questions. One is I have a wonderful rugosa rose. Got it from Pickering in Ontario some years ago. And I'd like to prune it a little bit. If I cut it back in the spring, will that disturb the blooms?
Here's what you want to do with your rugosa rose. The best way to do your pruning, and no, you'll be fine, but what I would suggest with any of your shrub roses is every couple of years, take a stem, one of the bigger, fatter canes, right back to ground level.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. Darn. That I know how painful that is, believe me.
No, that's okay. It's really pretty much out of control.
Yeah, and so you can,
like where it's growing.
Yeah, and so you can do that and get it cut back. And then after you've got your first flush, because you typically get, this is not a repeat blooming rugosa. Some of the newer ones
are. Well, it bloomed all summer.
Yeah, so you know what you'll do? I'd take a few of those old stems right back to ground level, and then I would reduce the height as needed. And you might impact that first flush of blooms, but then you'll have lots of them as you go.
But good.
I think if you take a few of those stems out, and if you do, the benefit is if you do it every other year or so, it's one or two stems versus a whole lot, and it's the plant looks better and it's a lot easier for you.
Great. I have another quick question.
Sure.
I have some dreadful escaping ground cover that I never wanted. I don't know where it came from. It's either called Bishop's Weed, Snow on the Mountain, or Goutweed. And if I put matted leaves on some of the patches that aren't too close to the flowers, will that help weaken it in the spring so I'll have better luck trying to control it or get it out?
I heard that the reason they call it Bishop's Weed is it's aggressive enough to make even a bishop swear. And you're probably thinking, yeah, that's got to be true, right? I just talked about how leaves are not a good insulator and it's not, you could try it, but I wouldn't count on it. This stuff, as you know, and anybody that's tried to deal with it, Roundup, Finale, may slow it down slightly. Digging it, it's hard to get all of the root system. It comes back. It's one of those persistent things that you really need to keep after it, and it's going to take years to get it under control. Mulching isn't going to hurt if that's all that's there. That might, edge that bed, and then throwing some mulch down might help it. Clear plastic during the heat of the growing season might help slow it down, but then you're not planting in that area, but at this point that may be okay. So, you might want to pile some leaves, see what happens in the spring. Be prepared to see it grow right through there. And then what you may want to do is hit it with Roundup or Finale, paint it right on the leaves. If you don't mind using an herbicide, it'll absorb, for Roundup, it's absorbed in and will help kill some of the roots. Finale, it reacts differently, but helps weaken the roots. And you're just going to have to do several applications to get it under control. And you might just say, I'm not going to plant anything there until I get it under control, because it's easy. easier to deal with than if you've got perennials that you want mixed in. And it could have come in on birds, could have come in on a transplant.
Never know.
You never know.
Thanks for calling. Mike in Seneca, your turn. Hi, Mike.
Good morning. I have another one of these gift plant type questions.
Okay.
It's a hibiscus, and it's about 5 years old, but it's at somebody else's house, and she's got a green thumb, and it's my mother's, and she wants me to take it, and it's probably like 2 foot in diameter, maybe 3 foot high, and it's in the original pot that it came in, which is a little deeper than a typical hanging basket size. And I feel that it should be repotted, and it has this typical light soil in, too. And I was just wondering soil mixture and how big a pot.
Okay.
Cut it back quite a bit, and then it starts new growth and blooming in the house. Mm-hmm. But it takes so much room that she was going to cut it back, and I says, well, I'd like to watch you so I know how to do it. And anyway, that's kind of the long and the short of it.
Yeah, right. And you know, and there's nothing worse than getting a plant from your mother, okay? That's just like the kiss of death. So we're going to try to help you with that one, Mike. And really, hibiscus are not as bad if you just get over when they're moved, the leaf drop and that type of thing. With house plants in general, and I just want to emphasize this for any of them, you know, our first reaction is, well, if I put it in a really big pot, I won't have to transplant it again for a long time. The problem with that is you've got all this potting mix and no roots, and it leads to root rot. Or it will lead to a lot of root development. Once it gets pot bound, then you're going to get more top growth and more bloom. So as tempting as it is to go bigger, I would just go 1 to 2 inches bigger in diameter, you know, about that size, the next size or two up, no more. If it's been in that pot for 5 years, the roots maybe growing in a circle. So as you pull it out of the container, if they're girdling, that's called girdling, and they're circling the root ball, loosen those up. You can either take a knife and slice through them or just kind of tease them loose with your fingers. That's going to encourage them to root into that fresh soil. And then I'd use any, you know, I think we all have our favorite brand of potting mix we like to use, but I like to find something that for me is consistent and has, you know, good organic matter. Most of them are pretty similar. Just look for a reliable brand that you've heard good things from your gardening friends. I use Fafford, which is used by professionals, and they've just come into the retail market, and they do some private branding as well. But there's lots of good potting mixes out there. Just find one that works. Because it's in a bigger pot, because the soil might be slightly different or the potting mix, you may have to adjust the watering schedule too. So if she watered once a week, you may need to water less frequently because you've got a little more potting mix, or more often because it may be a little better drained. So just kind of monitor it, which just adds to that stress of, you know, monitor water thoroughly. When the soil is just slightly damp, it's time to water again.
And thanks, Mike, for calling. Appreciate it. Corrine and Eau Claire, we're on to you. Hi, Corrine.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Number one, I'm up in Eau Claire where I'm on just on the border of the zone 3, and I have had luck with lavender that actually has been planted under a cherry tree, so it must have some protection there.
Excellent. Thank you.
The second one is I've sold my house. I now have some beautiful bulbs for tulips that I've bought, thinking that maybe I could force those in a, not force, but plant them in a pot so that I could enjoy them in the spring. Is that suggestible, or what should I do with these beautiful bulbs I bought?
That's a great question. I love to force bulbs for indoor enjoyment. The downside is if you put them in a container and leave them outside, they usually freeze solid. That, you know, little small pot of soil isn't enough to insulate the bulb. So a couple things you can do. A friend of mine said every good gardener has an extra refrigerator, one for the beverages of choice and the other for your bulbs, okay? Yeah. So you could pot them, you could chill them, put them in some peat moss, you know, or if the pots, if you've got enough room and the containers are small, put them in the refrigerator for about 15 weeks to give them that chill. An unheated garage sometimes is good. You just have to be careful that it's not going to get too cold. I think, you know, Larry had one time given a suggestion about put a board underneath anything you ever winter. I'm like, that is a good idea. And then I always insulate them with all that insulation material in my garage, the junk that I have in there. And I have a couple of pots that I'm overwintering flowering in my unheated garage, but stuck in the corner. And then I don't know if you're in your new home yet, or if you have a friend that could sink the pots in the ground. So a lot of times I'll pot them up in an ugly, you know, just like a nursery pot, sink it in the ground. They get the chill, and then in spring lift them out if the ground isn't frozen and enjoy them inside.
Wonderful. My next question is: I bought this amazing plant. It's called Angel's Trumpet.
Oh yes.
Obviously not hardy to our area. I brought it in, and it's just the most amazing plant. I think that when it flowers, it doesn't last 24 hours, but then it somehow inverts itself and turns almost into this prickly, round. it's amazingly gorgeous. I've brought that in. I don't have very much sunshine, but I do have it in my south window. Just that's the best sun it's going to get. And wonder if you have any suggestions, and if you would like to elaborate what you know about the Angel's Trumpet, because it is really gorgeous.
It is a cool plant. There are the clumpers and the dividers, and there's a group of plants called Datura that some people have put into the Brugmansia genus. And why am I telling you this? It's a great way to look for more information. Some people believe the Datura's are the upward-facing, the Brugmansia are the downward-facing. I'm like, there's enough plant names. I'm throwing them together. The seeds are very, very toxic on those, so you want to be very careful. In fact, there was some discussion that in some reference I found in Egypt that when the pharaoh died, they'd make a concoction of this for their wife and bury her alive with him.
Oh.
So she's all drugged up, and you know, can you imagine coming to in the pyramid? Not a happy thing. So they're very toxic, the seeds are. So you want to just store them carefully and deal with them that way. Inside, good sunny conditions, a little bit cool is okay, and then just water is needed. And a lot of that varies with how hot your house is, how dry the air is. Sometimes the challenge is just to keep them alive. I'd hang on to those seed pods, though, store them in a cool, dark place, or take them out of the seeds out of the seed pod. Store them in the refrigerator. And the reason we put seeds in the refrigerator is not for chilling necessarily. Some seeds need that. But even those that don't need chilling, that 42 consistent temperature is good. Otherwise, find a place where you have some good, cool, consistent temperature. They're incredible, great in containers, really very dramatic in the garden. I saw them a lot when I started my career. In the 70s, we saw quite a few of them. Then in the 80s, everybody was worried, and castor beans and angel trumpets, nobody was selling them because of the toxicity. And I've seen they kind of make a resurgence. So, you know, I think animals are usually pretty smart, not my cats, but most animals are pretty smart about not eating poisonous things. And with kids, I think the prickly seed pod helps discourage them. But if you have kids in the area, you know, keep them away or plant them in an area where it's hard to reach. But really a fun plant that looks beautiful in containers, and you'll have to let me know how yours does over winter.
I'll be curious. And thanks so much.
Thanks a lot for calling. Judy wonders if you can use pine needles for mulch this winter. Do they need a lawnmower treatment first?
Great question. Pine needles are an excellent mulch for the soil, not for covering your plants, obviously. But I do a lot of mulching with shredded leaves. Pine needles are wonderful. Our soils tend to be very alkaline in the southern part of the state. I'm not sure where she said she was from. So it's not a concern about acidity. Even in the north, the reason things don't grow there is they're a great mulch, and they prevent weeds, or the shade of the tree they're dropping from are shading things out, and a lot of competition for the other plants. So a great mulch in your garden during the growing season as well.
And with a three-year-old cherry tree, as Barbara wonders, she doesn't know anything about pruning, but I've read on the internet that I should be training it with a central leader and maintain 3 to 4 branches per level as the tree grows. Is that about right?
Yeah, and one of the things, depending on if it's a dwarf or a standard, usually looking at, you know, 7 to 9 branches total, you know, if you're doing 3 or 4 per swirl, but they should spiral up the trunk, not be 3 coming out at the same point. And pruning over the radio is always, I always figure people listen to me and they go out already and they get to the tree and go, I have no clue what she was talking about. That's about right. And the central leader has that main trunk, and then you want your branches as wide a crotch angle from the trunk to the branch. That should be wide, and then spiraling up the trunk is a good way. University of Wisconsin Extension has great publications on growing fruit. They have the southern versions and the northern versions in terms of cultivar recommendations, but the line drawings and the culture and care is excellent in there as well. So I think pictures can help immensely.
And, you know, we haven't mentioned your website. You've got a great website.
Well, thanks. MelindaMyers.com, so easy to remember. And I know I owe a few people some information on native plants for shady areas. Sorry. but we're doing some exciting things. I do a green tip of the day. So every day we've got a tip of something you can do in your garden, in your home, to be a little more eco-friendly. Videos, the Melinda's Garden Moments that air on network stations around the country. Last seasons are on, and you can access them. And I do podcasts.
And my books.
So it's a place, and we're adding a new database this fall. So stay tuned. Next visit, I'll have some really, I think, exciting news to share, a big addition to the website coming soon.
MelindaMyers.com. Melinda, thank you so much.
Thank you, Larry. Always a pleasure.
Melinda Myers will be back with us. She's been a wonderful guest, and she will continue to be a great guest here on Garden Talk. And thank you very much for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store.